Welcome to the Neo-Narcissism Podcast, hosted by emotional intelligence specialist Kimberly Weeks and strategic psychotherapist Brad Kaufman.
Hi, and welcome back. Today's episode, we want to delve in and talk to you all about the process of grief and what that looks like when this relationship with the narcissist comes to an end. All that you might experience, go through, and just the complexities of that. Yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of people, believe it or not, are surprised by the idea that the end of the relationship or the interaction or whatever it is with a narcissist, especially if you are invested in a meaningful relationship with it. I mean, you know, if it's a work situation and you get away from the narcissist at work, it's more relief than it is grief. But there may be grief if you really love the job, but you couldn't work next to a narcissist or for a narcissist necessarily. But yeah, if you're really invested into it, it is loss, right? So in psychology, we often talk about it being a form of ambiguous or undefined loss, right? So in defined loss, or what you would typically consider grief to be, right? If a loved one passes away, people show up at your door with a casserole. That's a pretty defined loss because the community knows there's usually a social event around the loss itself, and you aren't just trying to process it individually on your own in some form of isolation. There is more a community aspect to it. So in this undefined loss, you know you're going through some form of ambiguous loss when you're feeling all of this grief, but nobody's showing up with a casserole. Unless there's a really close friend who understands what you're going through or has been through it themselves and they show up with a casserole or something like that, mm-hmm. right? Or, you know, a box of tissues or some bubbly water or whatever it is, right?
Yeah. So I like this defining it, separating it this way. I think that's really going to be helpful, partly because, too, other people may not, and you may not, expect yourself to be feeling the depth of grief that you are leaving an unhealthy relationship. There's this concept that you might be judging yourself to feel like, well, I should be relieved. I should be happy. Everything should be, from this date forward, just progressive and moving forward, and everything's going to be sunshine and roses and easy. So when you stumble on, and it, you know what, actually might feel that way for a very short period of time, there might be a sense of relief, depending on how toxic that relationship is and what the how that came to an end. But then the grief will hit and it might feel confusing as to why you are hurting so much when potentially that person was so awful.
Yeah, and it always goes back to there was a reason you were in the relationship in the first place, right? There were either family ties or there, you know, was some love bombing in the romantic sense and you got pulled into that. You shared a lot of history with the person. You shared a lot of, you know, positive experiences. So there's a lot of positive things that go into it. And like you're saying, this kind of ties into our previous episode where we talked about the integration or integrating the narcissist, right? Integrating your experience of the narcissist, where it's not this isolated thing where it's all good or all bad. There's a part of it. So even if you have to get away from the bad, or even if that person discarded you, and the discard is so extremely painful, or having to step away from something toxic or unhealthy is difficult to do, like you're talking about, there's a certain level of relief that can come from getting broken apart from that toxicity. Now, of course, if there's that trauma bond, it takes a while to come to the sense of relief. And up front, when there is a strong trauma bond, up front, you have nothing but grief, right? You have nothing but pain. It's literally all consuming. And so all of your attention, the nervous system wants to spend all of its time on that. Your emotional centers, your psychological centers, even a lot of your physical hormonal centers are all wanting to kind of process that. So you can't focus at work. You don't really feel like being social with anybody. You just want to, maybe I've said this before, shut up, shut in, shut down, and shut out, right? If you have that experience, you know you're in the grief process. You really have no energy for anything else. Mm-hmm.
Can we just take a moment here and just for our listeners, define again trauma bond?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in the process of interacting or being in a relationship with a narcissist, it's a polarized experience. There's high highs and there's really low lows. So this creates a unique chemical soup where it's very equivalent to the gambling brain, right? There's a reason that they make these slot machines with intermittent reinforcement, right? Like randomized reinforcement where you can press the button and you don't win, you don't win, you don't win, you win, right? You don't win, you win. And you know, it's just very variable. You never know where it's going to be. Because, of course, research shows if it's predictable intervals, you don't actually, the reward system doesn't respond in the same way. It has to be unpredictable. And this is literally what TikTok does too. Like they'll literally sometimes put in videos that they know, according to the algorithm, you won't be interested in so that you keep scrolling for that next hit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's the same thing with the trauma bond. Is you're waiting for that next mountaintop experience with the narcissist. You've had them in the past, they've love bombed you, so you know it's possible, and they'll drop crumbs out, and they will. They'll pull you to a high really quick, but then they'll also pull you to a low. So now, do you wanna explain a little bit further?
No, I think that was really good. I just wouldn't drop a term like that. I just make sure our listeners understand what we're referring to there. Mm-hmm. So then back to the grief process.
Let me jump in with a little bit of another caveat here. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are going to be asking, so they'll be able to identify their own grief. They'll be able to say, yeah, like that, it's the most painful thing. If they're in the midst of just ending things with the narcissist or the narcissist ending it with them, you will be able to identify with this complete overwhelming, you don't know how you're going to get through it. It's all consuming. You're just trying to make sense of what just happened to you. Mm-hmm. And you just won't know how to make any sense, or you won't be able to believe it, right? So there's a sense of automatic instant denial that this is actually happening. I remember sending a text saying, how is this us? Right? And that's just a statement in disbelief. Because of course, what you're led to believe it actually is, the illusion that you're pulled into, and then this addictive trauma bond. Now,
it's very disorienting.
Yes, it's very disorienting. Now, here's a caveat that I wanted to jump into. A lot of people are going to have the question of, does a narcissist experience grief? But let's put that on hold for a little bit. We will get to it. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your own grief first.
Yeah. Yeah, this is your healing journey. So this sense of disorientation, like the imagery always comes to me is right away is this idea of being like taken out by a wave in the ocean, and you get sort of like tumbled around underneath, and you can't quite, not really sure which way the surface is, right? And you can fight against it, and that often makes you even more confused as to which way the surface is. So if you're experiencing that disorientation, I think that's a very normal part of it. I think that's the confusion within the grief. It's both of those kind of mixed together. It's an exhausting process. The grief process as a whole is exhausting. It is literally using energy from you. So if you were feeling like you're beating yourself up because I don't want to go do this, or I can't do that, or I'm exhausted all the time, or can't even make yourself a meal, a lot of times people will feel like Well, they're depressed, and they shouldn't be depressed because they're not in this unhealthy situation anymore. I think judgment can come in here a lot. And maybe, I'm not saying people aren't maybe depressed as well, but I would suggest to people to try to tease out as best they can, what is grief? Because grief, it's got its own word to it, but it is everything all at once. It is all of the emotions happening, colliding at the same time. This is a depth of sadness. It is a depth of anger and pain and a heartache you might not have felt before in a different way. It could be even peace and wrestling with that how dare I feel peace, you know, in a situation like this, but maybe that's in there too. It's quite a thick, muddy experience.
Yeah, and it's overwhelming. There's a reason why a lot of people in the process will say, it feels like I'm sinking in quicksand and there's nothing I can do to get out. And it is all consuming. So I like to talk about the ratio of grief. So when loss happens, especially unexpectedly, the ratio is 100% grief. So if you think of this being like a pie chart, the whole thing is grief. Now, as time goes by and you actually process all of the emotions, now this is what's, grief is a complicated process because like we were talking about, it's everything all at once. It's all of these experiences all at once. And, you know, unfortunately they used to talk about grief, the stages of grief, but grief doesn't have stages, it has tasks.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so all the, you know, conventional stages that they used to talk about, those are actually tasks. Now, the thing is, these tasks aren't a one-time task. It's cycling through. So we talk about the waves of grief. So now, sometimes you can catch some air. So in that pie chart ratio that I'm talking about, you know, maybe 99% of the time you're in grief, but you have 1% where you, oh, I felt normal for like a minute,
yeah,
right? Or I laughed for a second or this or that, but it's very, very quick and it's very, very fleeting before you're back into. So it's like big waves on an ocean. When you first get hit by it, it bowls you over. You're tumbling through. It's a perfect metaphor. You're tumbling through. You just come to the surface, get a little bit of air and boof, it knocks you over again. And anybody who's been in the ocean or had this experience with waves knows exactly what I'm talking about here. It's a very overwhelming, panic-stricken time. But now, as we talk about tasks, grief itself is an internal task. So you were talking about, oh, you can't make a meal. A meal is an external task. Things at work, like you have to write that memo, or you have to do this, or you have to meet with this person or that person. That's an external task. That dish in the sink that, you know, took zero energy before your life blew up, now looks like that it feels impossible, that one dish in the sink. That's an external task. So why does that one simple external task feel so overwhelming? It's because the internal task of grief, all of the processing that you have to do internally to get through it is completely overwhelming you. It's completely consuming you. And so you have to look at legitimizing that task. We aren't good in our culture at legitimizing internal tasks. Mm-hmm. We're good at saying, oh, I need to get out there and mow the lawn. We aren't good at saying, I need to sit down and process, you know, this emotion that I'm having right now.
Yeah, I think adding that value to the internal tasks is really important here. Also, it's a big ask because how uncomfortable. We are asking people to let the waves hit you and gasp for that air. And while you're under there, look around, explore the information. There's going to be, we've talked about before, happy memories sitting there. And then why there's so much pain because of that.
Yeah, I want to kind of reiterate that. Anything that felt that it had a really positive, enjoyable charge to it in the relationship, in the realm of grief, feels the most painful, right? We don't really miss those crappy moments. We aren't grieving those crappy moments. We're more grieving those great moments that we actually had. So whenever those positive memories come up, that positive charge is what now makes you feel charged, or the intensity of the pain of that not being possible anymore.
You're also grieving hope and all of the not reciprocated effort that you put in the hopes of a return to the beginning of the relationship, a return to the love bombing stage, the promise of who you believe them to be or who they sold themselves to be. You have to grieve all of that as well.
Okay. I'm sure as people are listening here, they're starting to realize the complexity of grief, because now you're touching on the ripple effect of grief, especially if you had a very integrated life with a narcissist, if you lived with a narcissist and your living situations changed, if you had social connections with a narcissist, you know, all of these integrated pieces, it has this ripple effect across absolutely everything, right? And usually the tentacles of what that is, there's nothing that it doesn't touch. So it's a recalibration on a multitude of things simultaneously. And that's why I like to say, you know, everything is familiar, but nothing is the same. And a lot of people will feel this. Like, they'll try to go out with their friends and enjoy things they used to do with their friends, but it just doesn't seem enjoyable. It's familiar. It's the same people. It's the same faces. It's the same places. But it just feels different somehow, right? And so within this ripple effect, this is where the ambiguity of loss kind of goes further. So like you're talking about hope. The future that you hoped for, they will future fake you. They'll help you paint a picture of the future, and then they'll be the one to completely discard that or eliminate it by ending the relationship, by discarding you. Or yeah, if you realize all the toxicity that's going on and saying, I can't do this anymore, and you have to step away, you're gonna feel that loss as well. But believe it or not, we can grieve an idea just as much as we can grieve a person. Literally, I was at a birthday party for a family member last night, and my niece, who is 18 years old and isn't in a relationship right now, but she's, you know, hopeful like every young lady is, she pulls out this picture of this beautiful wedding dress, and you know, it's like, this is the wedding dress that I want to have. And you know, all the females are like, oh wow, that's absolutely beautiful. But she's already dreaming a future, right? She's creating that blueprint of a future, and yeah, hopefully that hope that she has will be fulfilled, and she'll get that dress and the wedding and the guy, and they'll live happily ever after, you know, in a healthy relationship. That is the hope, right? But if that hope is never fulfilled, there will be loss, there will be grief attached to it. So anyway, I digress a little bit here, but I wanted to jump in and just talk about that ripple effect. Yeah, and how, yeah, I guess all-encompassing it can be.
Yeah, so when we talk about the process, actually walking through this, what can people expect?
Okay, yeah, that's a great question. So up front, that pie chart is pretty much 99% to 100% grief. It's the 100% the internal task of pain, anger, sadness, disbelief, typically what we call denial. All of those things are playing into it. And so the body, the nervous system is trying to process everything. It's trying to recalibrate. Right? It's like landing in a new universe, and it is. You're just stuck with all of this churning going on, and the waves, people will feel the waves hit them, like they're just pulled in, and they're like, they can't focus on anything else. It's very inconvenient, especially if you have the type of job where you can't take a few weeks off initially, or a couple weeks off initially, just to be able to process things. It's like you just have to shoestring your way through the first bit, and it's almost like saying, okay, no, I will get to my grieving when I get home. I'll just collapse, I'll fall on the couch, right? A lot of people have zero energy. It feels like they've been running that emotional marathon, which they are, you know, all day long. And so, and we talked about this in Loving the Love Out. When you genuinely invested and you genuinely loved in this relationship, you just have to keep the process of that love moving forward. It's painful because there's no place for it to land, or no place for you to practically express it. But essentially it is, and people don't like this answer. When I say, like, give me the magic pill so I don't have to feel the pain. It's, and like we talked in Loving the Love Out, we talked about that saying from that show, what is grief if not love enduring? And so love becomes painful in the context of grief. And so you just have to love the love out and, yeah, allow the pain to be present. Now, like we talked about previously, a lot of people are afraid to get stuck in the pain, that they don't want to go there with it. You don't get stuck in joy, but you freely allow yourself to experience it fully. The pain, yeah, don't worry, all your coping mechanisms are still there. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you have to sit with your pain endlessly. There are going to be natural tendencies to want to go cope. And those of you listening, you all know what your coping vices are. Those vices are going to, you know, come forefront, and they're going to try to want to help you get through this process. If you engage them too much without allowing the process of pain to happen, or build that relationship with pain, healthy relationship with pain, you're literally deferring it to a later date.
Right. So I like how you said that in terms of indulging them too much, because it's actually okay to give yourself the reprieve from that in using those coping vices, whatever they are, in moments. But what we're talking about is purposefully and knowing with a depth of awareness of what you're doing, so that it gives you that little bit of maybe gasp of air on the surface, so that you can go back under and continue the process. Mm-hmm. It's not about using those coping strategies or vices as vices, because they're not really strategies, as a distraction from the process.
Mm. Well, I would say it is a strategy, actually. Mm. Yeah, because it's kind of like having a bottle of oxygen. And in the waves, you can suck on the oxygen and be okay. But at some point, the coping no longer works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the overindulging in it will delay the process. Mm-hmm. I would also say here, because you touched on something earlier, when you talked about not necessarily wanting to lean into the pain or to stay in it, you know, and it, we can try to avoid it. It's in that fear that you're going to get stuck there. Trying to not get stuck there is what keeps you in the pain, is the fear that you're never going to get out of it. So mm-hmm. therefore you never walk through that door. Mm-hmm. But it's really necessary to walk through that door. The only way out is through. Mm-hmm. So you get to really accomplish something, and it is an accomplishment. You will feel it is part of your, as Brad talks about, recalibration, or this reformatting of how you are in the world in a really powerful, empowered way that has a foundation of strength to it that you may not have experienced before. So if we can encourage people to have the courage of this really scary unknown of what that's going to feel like, to look at that pain, there's something really beautiful that you get to gather through that process. Because avoiding it because you think you'll get stuck is actually getting stuck.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as usual, you don't know how to deal with something until you know what you're dealing with. We'll see you next time.